I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. When he was running for president, Newt Gingrich warned that his grandchildren were going to live in a secular atheist country. Former GOP presidential candidate Rick Santorum went one step further when he said, starting with the French Revolution, moving on to the fascists and the Nazis and the communists and the Baathists, all of those purely secularists hated religion. Our guest, Jacques Berliner-Blau, says that Gingrich and Santorum and many others, including atheists, have a profound misunderstanding of secularism. That's why he wrote How to Be Secular, A Call to Arms for Religious Freedom, where he writes that secularism is our best way to protect religious freedom and encourage tolerance. Jacques Berliner-Blau is a professor at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service, director of the Program for Jewish Civilization, and a contributor to the Washington Post On Faith column, joins us from the studios of Georgetown University. And Jacques Berliner-Blau, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. So what do secularists believe?
They believe lots of things, but one thing they believe is that a society should be orderly, and there should be a maximum amount of freedom of religion and freedom from religion within the constraints of orderliness.
That sounds like a very simple, straight-ahead definition. Why has secularism been thrown in with atheism, as I was quoting both Gingrich and Santorum?
Probably around the 70s, when the religious right started to get organized and started to get its activism moving forward, I think they found that tarring the secular values of the nation, which implied a strict separation of church and state, was a very, very effective, it was effective to, to associate that with atheism. And they did a very, very good job of it, and secularism and atheism kind of became synonyms for one another, when in fact they're very, very different.
Well, as you write in your book and as you referenced earlier, secularism is a political philosophy connected with the best way to govern a complex, religiously pluralistic society. Expand on that definition, if you would.
Right. What secularism tries to do, secularism is based on a very, very old intuition. Let's call it a 16th, 17th century intuition.
That's pretty old.
It's pretty old. And the intuition goes something like this. Societies that permit religion to pervade government too much are structurally unstable, and they combust. So look at secularism as kind of the accumulated knowledge of what can go really, really wrong in a polity. So what secularism tries to do is it tries to monitor through a variety of strategies how religion and government will interact with one another.
And the idea that they're, what, side-by-side, kind of parallel institutions?
Could be. That's called separationism, right? Separationism is a doctrine that really took hold in the mid-20th century in the United States. And that's one way of being secular, and I personally like it very much, but I think separationism has been undermined and pulverized by the United States Supreme Court over the last couple of decades. So while I have nothing against separationism, I try to suggest some other ways that secularists might think of putting forward this really noble secular vision.
Expand what you mean when you raise some questions about this separationism.
Well, separationism is the idea that there must be, well, there are different types. This is what makes it interesting. There's total separationism, which is the idea that there must be a complete, absolute, hermetically sealed, vacuum-tight wall between church and state in this country. And this is sort of the way many Americans, especially on the left, think of our government. And it's a nice way to think of our government. The problem is that it's never happened, and it actually can't happen. And even those, let's say, Supreme Court justices who were very, very in favor of separationism, they acknowledge that total separation of church and state is an impossibility.
And I'm thinking of our coins. I'm thinking of the fact that a president will end a speech saying, "And God bless America." Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, and as Justice Douglas once said, if there's a fire at a church, does total separation of church and state mandate that the fire engine paid for by public funds can't go put out the fire in the church? Now, I know those examples seem to be a little bit facetious, but when you think about it, they're not, because the deeper problem is that we are historically a religious country, and 90% or so of Americans, or 85%, believe in God and are religious. So they're part of the state. So the idea of completely disentangling church and state as much as it has theoretical simplicity, and it seems like it would work, is a lot harder to effect than I think many secularists understood over the last couple of decades.
But the idea is that you don't want government establishing a religion.
Right. Now, that's disestablishmentarianism, and that's the pure First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Now, that's literally in the Constitution, right? That there shall be no establishment of religion. It's a little bit different from separationism, which, as critics on the Christian right have pointed out for decades, is not in the Constitution.
Let me talk a little bit about some of this history that secularism is based on, and let's go back a couple of centuries, because I think we need to understand Martin Luther, John Locke. These are people that you write about in our book. How does their view of religion and politics influence us today?
Yeah, I mean, they share that insight. There are two insights there. The first is about this structural instability problem, that it's just a bad idea for everyone when churches and states start to mingle. That's an old Christian intuition. If you read the New Testament, if you read Romans 13, 1 and 2, if you think of the famous verse from Matthew about rendering unto Caesar, Christianity has always had this deep-seated suspicion about what happens when power and faith collide. But another major, major impetus for the thought of Martin Luther, and I also want to mention Roger Williams and John Locke, is the idea of freedom of conscience. Right? Mm. So what they were very worried about was a state telling citizens what they could and couldn't believe, what was proper and improper, what was orthodox and what was heterodox. So if you think of it that way, secularism emerges, precisely as I try to describe it, as a vision of protecting freedom of conscience, religious liberty, the right of citizens to believe absolutely anything they want to believe. And as we build out the secular package in the 20th century, that also means the right not to believe.
Well, and that also speaks to their concern and perhaps even fears of the power of the state to intrude on people's lives and their belief systems.
Absolutely. There's a statist dimension to secularism, and there's an anti-statist dimension to secularism. Secularism tells the state there are places you cannot go, and one of those places we might refer to as the psychic sovereignty of the citizen. Citizens can believe anything they want. As long as their rituals and practices are within the parameters of the law, citizens can worship any way they want. That's a huge freedom historically. It took us a couple of millennia to get there. And as we know, there's still places on Earth today, societies, where those freedoms are not enumerated.
Indeed. Well, let's fast forward to the creation of this country. Do you think the United States is a Christian country?
No, I don't. But some very good conservative Christian historians have been making arguments over the past couple of decades, which I feel secularists have been very slow to digest. And the argument goes something like this, that at the founding of the nation, you had these two brilliant outliers, Mr. Madison and Mr. Jefferson, and they had a rather radical, noble, far-reaching vision of how the church and the state should interact with one another. But there were many other founders that, if you drill down and you listen to them, problematically, did think this was a Christian nation. So this is where I think a lot of the current polemics, especially in the academy and in the legal setting, are taking place. What did those founding fathers actually think this nation was about? And we secularists like to advance Mr. Madison and Mr. Jefferson. The difficulty with that is those on the Christian right have, well, they have a couple of dozen other founding fathers who said things which are very, very different and could be very troubling to our modern sensibilities.
So is that the root of our conflict over this issue in this country?
In the last 20 or 30 years, what happened was this. Ever since 1947, the Everson case, there had been this growing consensus in the United States Supreme Court that separation of church and state was a constitutionally guaranteed component of this country. Historians in the 70s and 80s and 90s, usually they were conservative Christians, but not always, started really revisiting that and asking themselves if the Warren Court got that right, if in fact separation of church and state was something that the founders envisioned for this nation. And this is where the problem set in. The scholarship is pointing to a much more problematic and ambiguous founding vis-a-vis the question of separationism than I think we believed from the 40s to roughly the 80s in this country.
Well, let me quote Justice Hugo Black when he said in this Everson case in 1947, he said, the wall of separation must be kept high and impregnable. We could not approve the slightest breach.
Yep. You know, if secularism had a kind of bobblehead doll of some sort, we'd have a Justice Hugo Black bobblehead. I mean, he's the great separationist of the 20th century. Of course, he wasn't the only Supreme Court justice. What Justice Black is doing there, and this is really part of the story I tell in How to Be Secular, is he's reviving a metaphor that emerged in an 1802 letter written by Thomas Jefferson, a private letter to the Danbury Baptists, right? So it's 1947 when that is written by Justice Black. And he's going back to 1802. That line itself was never mentioned again by Jefferson, though it was invoked in the 1878 Reynolds case, which was a case about Mormon polygamy. Why am I talking about this? Because what many legal scholars are pointing out is separation of church and state in terms of the proceedings of the United States Supreme Court from, let's say, I don't know, 1802 to 1947, really wasn't much of a concern in this country. It's only mid-20th century, that the separationist doctrine took flight, and I'm happy it did. The problem is there was a sort of backlash to that in the 70s and 80s, and we are experiencing that backlash right now.
But so do you think what Justice Black said was a kind of a red flag to the more, I guess, religious believers in this country?
At first, they didn't notice it, right? What we know is that in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, what is now the Christian right was in a kind of position of reconsolidating, reassessing, building out, right, theologically purifying. And it really actually didn't bother them very much. In the book, I point to a fascinating sermon by one Jerry Falwell. I'm sure you know him very well,
Indeed,
Marty.
Indeed, I do.
Where he argues that separation of church and state is actually kind of a good thing, and he's very worried about the civil rights movement and communism, which is encroaching on his door. And he delivers a sermon in the early 60s where he says, pastors, get back in your pulpits and get out of politics. We Christian folks, we don't do politics. So what I'm saying in the book is this idea of keeping church and state, I don't want to say separate, but very, very far apart from one another, is a Christian idea. It grows out of Christian political philosophy. I guess the great irony is that many on the Christian right seem to have forgotten that of late.
And we're almost having a break here, but was Falwell referring to someone like Martin Luther King Jr. who was, you know, mixing politics and faith?
Absolutely. And he was terrified at the prospect of all of that. And then he would turn around and flip-flop about 12 to 15 years later.
Well, we'll pick up on that after this very short break. Talking today on Radio Times with Jacques Berliner-Blau, and he's written a new book. It's called How to Be Secular, A Call to Arms for Religious Freedom. And he's a professor at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service, a director of the Program for Jewish Civilization. He's the author of four books and also a frequent contributor to the Washington Post On Faith column. And we'll pick up where we left off, talking about Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson and the revivalist, as our guest calls them, after this very short break. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The theater at Raritan Valley Community College supports WHYY and presents An Evening with Fran Lebowitz, Saturday, September 29th at 8 p.m. The cultural satirist and chronicler of the Me Decade will offer insights on timely issues such as gender, race, gay rights, and the media, as well as her own pet peeves including celebrity culture, tourists, and strollers. Tickets and more information to An Evening with Fran Lebowitz online at rvccarts.org.
Flipping through the radio, you're likely to hear the same songs over and over again.
But there's always a wealth of great music beyond the dial. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot.
And this week on Sound Opinions, the world's only rock and roll talk show, Greg and I dig up a new batch of buried treasures. Tune in to hear these underground gems get some well-deserved airplay.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Rusher and Baker was about to make a try for a demanding public office when his wife was diagnosed with dementia. But instead of hiding her condition, the family decided to go public with their challenge.
She was determined to handle everything, supportive of the children and of me, and we wanted the public to know.
We'll hear more of his poignant story next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Jacques Berliner Blau, and he says in his new book that secularism is one of our best ways to protect religious diversity, the right to practice religion or no religion. He says secularism has been hijacked by both the extreme right and extreme atheists, and his book is called How to Be Secular, A Call to Arms for Religious Freedom. And we have calls coming in to 1-888-477-9499. So picking up where we left off about, as you said, Jerry Falwell basically calling for this sort of broad separation between religion and politics, what changed his mind?
Well, what changed his mind was the freewheeling, acid-popping 60s, I guess. The 60s changed a lot of Christian conservatives' minds. They re-entered the game, interestingly enough, with the candidacy of Jimmy Carter in 1976, who was an evangelical. So two things happened at once. They looked back to the 60s. In 1973, of course, there was the Roe v. Wade case, though that's a little bit more complex in terms of Protestant activism. And then there was the candidacy of Jimmy Carter, which brought them into politics. But by 1979, they latched on to Ronald Reagan, the moral majority is formed, and the rest is American history.
But is their goal a theocracy?
No, I don't think so. Though on the fringes, you really do get that feeling, and a lot of their public pronouncements make it seem that way. I think their goal is a more godlier nation, precisely, though, in terms of the godliness that they would like. That's always a problem when you proclaim a godly nation. Everyone has a different vision of it. So theirs would be a uniquely evangelically godly nation. They've never really kind of told us what it would look like, right? They don't need to, because their activism sort of speaks for itself.
But in a religiously diverse country, that clearly is problematic.
It's deeply, deeply problematic. And what I notice in the book is when you let them speak, in other words, when they actually talk about what their vision is for the United States and what they think about other religious groups, then all of a sudden people become very, very secular. They start understanding why we established these walls or hedges or lines between church and state in the first place.
Well, and there's always the problem of intolerance, and you can't speak broadly about people's religious beliefs, but I think one has to be very careful about this belief and notion of tolerance.
Right. Toleration, this is really coming up a lot now with the very, very unfortunate goings-on in the Middle East. Right now we're having a national conversation, or at least our State Department is, on two subjects, religious freedom and religious toleration. The strange thing, and I don't know, Marty, if you want to get into foreign policy and what's going on, but we certainly can, is that everything is sort of upside down in this discussion. We are a secular country, right? But we're speaking as if we're ashamed of our own secular heritage, and I do find this a little bit troubling.
Well, speaking because so much is going on in the Arab world in reaction to several things, including this ridiculously crude angry, divisive film, but in reading about and trying to understand the reaction to that particular film, one gets a sense that there's a different view about what religious freedom is all about.
Absolutely. And I would really advise the United States State Department to clearly articulate how we understand religious freedom in this country. Some of the pronouncements over the past couple of days I found really unsatisfactory, kind of apologizing for the fact that we have in our First Amendment freedom of speech. And freedom of speech is an American value. One need not like that particular provocative film to understand that this is a core belief. This is really at the center of what we as Americans believe to be true about our democratic polity. And I'm simply not hearing that emphasis coming from Secretary Clinton's remarks and from the State Department in general and the president.
Well, and I think there is a belief, rightly or wrongly, and again, I'm always nervous about speaking broadly about groups of people, but the idea that if a film like this is made, then it has to have the stamp of approval of the government, and Maybe even the president of the United States.
Right. That is a huge cultural misunderstanding, and I actually do think we've tried to explain that. If you look at Secretary Clinton's remarks, she's made quite a few very interesting pronouncements on this. She really is trying to explain that this is the work of a private citizen. This does not represent the official worldview of the United States. It seems pretty obvious to me. I think the actors on the ground throughout the Middle East probably understand that themselves, right? But for other deeper reasons, which have nothing to do with what we're speaking about here, it's important to put on this kind of pageantry of outrage throughout that part of the world.
I mean, we've had our own versions of this struggle where something is considered offensive, but we don't censor it.
Right, we don't censor it at all. And I want to go back to Falwell for a second. This is very, very important. Secularism works when religious groups play by the rules of the game. And you can say what you want about the Christian right. They've always played by the rules of the game, all right? And what is the most fundamental rule of the game in terms of the secular worldview? When something happens that you don't agree with, you do not resort to violence. And the Christian right in the United States has never, under any circumstances, even come close to that, and almost never threatened to go there. So we have to kind of look back, step back, and appreciate what it is that we have created in the United States and how many religious groups really do buy in, ultimately, to that secular vision.
Let me just, and we could spend a whole hour on Roe v. Wade, but I think it's important to understand that court decision and how it has brought up this fight over secularism, over the role of church and state.
Sure. The reason why I referenced earlier, it's a little complex when it comes to Roe v. Wade. Roe v. Wade initially outraged conservative Catholics in the United States. This is not widely known. Many scholars write about this, but it's funny that it hasn't permeated the national consciousness. Conservative evangelical Protestants were a little slow to get on that. It took them about a year or two. There are even some very ambiguous statements in some of the various denominations, Protestant denominations, public policy statements about what they thought of Roe v. Wade. Conservative Catholics were, from the get-go, outraged. It took a while for Protestant evangelicals to get in on that as well. And then the coalition started to come together and really show itself to be a formidable, really formidable force in American politics, to the point that, as one scholar has pointed out, Jerry Falwell precipitated the most significant voter realignment in American history since, let's say, the time of FDR. We should never underestimate the significance of that accomplishment.
And do you see a direct line from Roe v. Wade to the debate today over contraception and the Affordable Care Act?
Sure. I think the 60s, there were other things as well. I mean, there was the explosion of gay rights, women's rights, the fact that religious minorities are coming more and more out of the closet and demanding their civil rights, the explosion of the drug culture, the rise of the porn industry. There are many, many sort of prongs or pricks, if you will, that really agitated the Christian right and sent them hurling into action. Now, the point I want to make is when they got into the political arena, once they realized the game was on, they were devastatingly effective in a way that secularists during the same period were not.
Well, let me just quickly reintroduce you, and that's Jacques Berliner Blau, our guest today on Radio Times. He's a professor at Georgetown University and author of a new book called How to Be Secular, A Call to Arms for Religious Freedom. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Well, we've been talking about the revivalists, as you call them, Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, and others. Here's what you say about American atheists. You say American atheist movements, though fancying themselves a lion, are more like the gimpy little zebra crossing the river full of crocs. What do you mean? And that's C-R-O-C-S.
The river, right, not the shoes.
Yeah.
There's a type of extreme atheist activism, which I don't think has been very, very effective in terms of the issues of interest to American atheists. But more importantly, many atheists have taken the term secular as their own. And that's really my only major concern there, that we're confusing secularism and atheism. With that said, we do have a problem in this country with anti-atheist prejudice. It is real. It does need to be dealt with, right? So atheists are good people. They are moral people. They are great Americans. And to the degree to which the atheist groups make that point, more power to them. Problematically, they do sometimes tend to engage in provocative acts, which I don't think are serving the political interests of their base.
Well, and I know you're referencing people like Richard Dawkins, the late Christopher Hitchens, very public about their atheism or anti-theism, and having interviewed both of them several times, I know part, and I don't want to do a show about atheism with right. you, but I know one of their objections is this notion of an interventionist God. Mm. You know, you want to win the football game, so you pray to God.
Right.
You want to get an A on your test, so you pray to God. And I know, having talked with them broadly speaking, that was one point to which they really were very rankled by.
Yeah, I mean, they get into these metaphysical scrums, Professor Dawkins and the late Christopher Hitchens. I don't really think they brought anything to the table that was too interesting. Now, one thing about the metaphysical scrums, I think the atheist movement, if you look at it right now, is going through a variety of convulsions. There's a lot of schism, mm-hmm. As the British say. And many in the movement, as far as I can tell, really want a clearer political vision. This is the Atheist Plus group, which I'm just reading a little bit about, and it's often led by women. And I think for the first 5 or 6 years, the New Atheist Platform was this sort of metaphysical name-calling, where you had usually older white men talking about how stupid religious people were and engaging in these fabulous debates down on campus. Right. And then nothing happened politically. So many women in the movement, now I'm not an expert on this, I'm just watching it, I think they'd like to see results, right? And women who are non-believers and believers feel the kind of force of the Christian right in their bodies in terms of reproductive freedoms or in terms of wage equity. So you're noticing a metaphysical, like a backing up on metaphysical issues in terms of atheist movements. And I think ultimately that might be a very, very good thing.
My feeling is that most atheists keep their beliefs to themselves.
Yeah, most atheists are like most Americans, right? There's this huge middle in the United States. And one of my complaints in the book is we're not hearing the middle. We're hearing the extreme atheists and we're hearing the Christian right. We're not hearing about the Reformed Jew or the liberal Catholic or the moderate atheist who is married to a liberal Catholic. I mean, this is what America is. And I'm really wondering who speaks for these folks. And I want to laud journalists such as yourself for focusing attention on somebody like myself that is drawing attention to them. But they really, really are underrepresented, which is a shame because they're really very large.
In fact, you say there's something that could be learned from American Jews about how they've been able to navigate this very roiling world that we live
right.
in here.
Right. When American Jews are, along with, strangely enough, Jehovah's Witnesses, that's a whole different story, mm-hmm. are kind of heroes of the First Amendment. And American Jews in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, as they got their platforms in shape and they understood what their political interests were, came to a very fundamental conclusion. And all religious groups do this, right? Secularism is the friend of religious minorities, right? Keeping government and religion kind of far apart is good for all minority groups, and Jews really led on this issue, and they made very valuable contributions to the secular vision.
In fact, you say, and I do want to get to some callers here, but just not exactly in summary, but you also you say that religious moderates and secularists have a lot in common, and if they could figure out how to join forces, might be a powerful political force in the country.
Absolutely. In fact, I refer to religious moderates as secularists. I use another term, the secular-ish. We can talk about secular-ish later, perhaps something.
A lot of definitions, yes.
A lot of definitions. I'm a professor, after all. So, the religious moderates and the secularists, there's basically a down-the-line, atheists, there is a down-the-line concurrence on, I don't know, every major political issue of the day. The great enigma is why these two blocks, one very large religious moderates, right? One very small and very intelligent atheist moderates, why they've never been able to lock arms.
And the issues you think that they agree on are?
Oh, absolutely. The proper place of religion in government. All right, there are other issues concerning the environment, concerning the role of science in public policy, concerning what is acceptable at a public school. So there are really a variety of issues that they will concur on.
Let me get some callers in. We have Justin, who called us up from Philadelphia. Justin, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. Sure. Just on the point of what you've been saying, I am an atheist happily married to a moderate and secular Muslim. big cheers there. On this point about secularism not being atheism, it seems to me, and as an outsider I may be out of my depth here, but it seems to me that there's something just definitionally about religious faith that seems to be opposed to that idea. And that is that if you do believe in God, then by definition, you believe that to some extent, at least, you are in the service of a being that, by definition, has dominion over the entire universe and everything in it. And that seems to, what seems to follow logically from that idea is that if your views are not supreme, then to some extent you're being suppressed and persecuted. And anything that is not part of your worldview is inherently against your worldview. I don't know if I expressed that clearly, but I'd like to have our guests comment on that.
Me too, Justin, and thanks for the call to Radio Times. Jacques, you want to take that?
Yeah, it's a good question. Justin, this is what I would say. Christianity, let's start there, is really, really interesting in this regard, because in the Christian scriptures, you have verses that tell Christians they have to be obedient subjects of the God-ordained authority. So that kind of complexifies the way you presented the problem, right? So God doesn't tell the individual Christian, you must have dominion over everything. On the contrary, what do you do with these verses in Romans, in Peter, in Matthew, that enjoin the Christian to be an obedient subject of the state and not to get wound up in political scrums? So I do think there's far more subtlety and complexity in all of these religions. Here's another quick point vis-a-vis Islam. A wonderful book is by Professor Abdullahi An-Na'im called Islam and the Secular State. I've spoken about this book at length. An-Na'im argues that contrary to prevailing misconceptions, right, classical Islam absolutely respects, understands, and even tries to enforce a type of distance between government and religion. So I feel the more we know about these religions, the more we read them and understand them and see how complex and ambiguous and vast they are, we'll see that there are all sorts of possibilities there, not just one possibility.
And is that part of the problem in that we don't know about other people's religions and have a kind of profound ignorance of our own religions?
Yeah, this is where the American professorate could play such a huge role for a variety of very complicated reasons. It hasn't, but professors in the American Academy know so much about these religions, and for whatever reasons, nobody listens to them. So part of my job is to just show the world all this great research coming from the academy, from these professors, that could really make our discussion a lot richer.
Professors like yourself, would you say?
Oh yeah, I'm one of them as well. But there are a lot of men and women more intelligent than I, and just no one knows who they are. And in the book, I do try to draw attention to some of that great research.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation, talking with Jacques Berliner Blau, and he does have a new book called How to Be Secular, A Call to Arms for Religious Freedom. He's a professor at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service, director of the Program for Jewish Civilization, and a contributor to the Washington Post On Faith column. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Medford Lee's, a not-for-profit community serving those ages 55-plus and guided by Quaker principles, supports WHYY. This fall, there's an opportunity to explore, learn, and discover with Medford Lee's as they launch their new Pathways series. Pathways features public programming on topics covering art, politics, music, history, horticulture, and more. Full details about Medford Lee's public events, educational programming, and its campuses in Medford and Lumberton, New Jersey, are online at medfordlees.org.
Crying Some of us do it more than others, and the result can be mixed. We feel better, worse, maybe embarrassed. And research tells us tears aren't just salty. They're a chemical mix that's different in men and women. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, we'll talk about why we cry, when we cry, and how crying works therapeutically. That's today at noon here on WHYY-FM.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Have you been feeling anxious, worried, on edge? The Integrative Medicine and Depression Research Unit at Penn Medicine is studying the causes and treatment of mood disorders. You may be eligible to participate in a research study looking at the effects of natural supplements to treat the symptoms of worry and anxiety. Initial evaluations determine eligibility for treatment. To learn more about Penn Medicine's Integrative Medicine and Depression Research Unit, 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Jacques Berliner-Blau about secularism. Let me just quote, this was a Pew survey of a couple of years ago, picking up on how much Americans do or don't know about religion. The Pew survey found that Americans did pretty poorly in understanding world religions, but also didn't know much about their own religions. We were talking about that before the break. But then they found that those who scored the highest on the survey were first atheists, then agnostics, then Jews, and then Mormons. And that survey has always stuck out for me, and I'd just be curious, does that tell us something we need to know?
Well, it's funny you mentioned that survey, Marty. I actually was very, very critical of that survey.
Oh, were you?
Yeah, so I wrote a long screed-like piece in the Washington Post about it. I've since then made peace with one of the folks who was responsible for it. They're onto something. There is widespread, I don't want to say ignorance. There's just a lot of misinformation out there. I think what that survey wanted to say, and this is just my opinion, I think that survey wanted to say we really need to bring religious instruction into public schools. Not doctrine, obviously, mm-hmm. right? But teach kids about the history of religion. And I think that's where that survey was going, and that's why it set up a red flag for me, because that's a very problematic constitutional issue with about 150 years of bad news associated with it. Be that as it may, yes, our level of complex religious understanding in this country is low, is very low.
Yeah, but also whether if one is sort of outside, you have to sort of understand the world that you live in. Maybe people spending more time trying to understand this religion if you're outside of it.
Yeah, absolutely. But how do we do that, right? And how do we do that in a secular state? The institution that one would think would be best equipped to perform that task for America would be the public school system. Mm-hmm. The public school system has so many difficulties right now from so many different directions, right? Like, one wonders, do we really want to build in this aspect, right? Do we want to have every constitutional lawyer in the United States looking at every local school and monitoring them for how they present, you know, Henri de Navarre or, you know, the St. Bartholomew's Massacre. This is really part of the difficulty of doing it. I repeat, I do think there's a huge place for professors down at your local bookstore, down at the seminary, down at the university, professors visiting public schools to talk about religion. I wish somebody would listen to me.
Well, we're listening to you.
Okay, yeah. But I'm just one.
I understand. Let me get Nancy from Lafayette Hill to join us. Nancy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Okay. I guess in keeping with Justin's open comment, I describe myself as a practicing Catholic who is politically liberal. Mm-hmm. What I want to remind you of and the listeners is that one of the greatest speeches in the 60s was John Kennedy in 1960, his speech to Texas ministers during the campaign, and I happened to have occasion, and that had a big effect in 1960.
Sure,
great.
And I happened to have occasion to reread it recently, and I would recommend for other people, and you could just Google and get it, I'm sure, but it was very detailed about what both religious organizations should and shouldn't do, and what the government shouldn't do. And I'll accept your answer off the air.
Nancy, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Jacques, go ahead.
Yeah, Nancy, great call. We know the speech very well in secularism. It's probably the high watermark of the separationist vision. Let me give you a little background on that speech. The poll quote, there are a lot of great quotes in that speech. The one we'll always know is Senator John F. Kennedy saying, "I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute." So here are two interesting kind of facts to shade that. The first thing is the audience he was speaking to on that day of mostly Protestant, I believe exclusively Protestant ministers, wanted him to say that. That's what he was supposed to say. He believed it, but that was the message they needed to hear to feel comfortable with this candidate, because they were worried that he'd be taking his marching orders from Rome, which has often been a scurrilous dual loyalty charge, which has been slung at Catholic Americans, right? So isn't that interesting? In 1960, that's what the Protestant audience wanted to hear. They wanted to be assured that he wasn't going to blur the lines between church and state, how we have changed. And here's the gloss on it. In 2012, Rick Santorum, being interviewed by George Stephanopoulos, was asked about that speech, and he said it made him want to vomit. Yes. So look how far we've come. Santorum is also Catholic, by the way. And there's a lot in that speech, Nancy, and there's a lot that we need to think about the greatness of liberal Catholicism and re-harnessing the power of liberal Catholicism. I teach at Georgetown University, which I do think represents that possibility. It seems to be somewhere in the doldrums right now, right? But it's a glorious vision, I assure you. I see it every day. And I wish it would re-enter American public space more forcefully.
Do you wish President Obama and Governor Romney would talk more about their faith?
Do I? No, I actually wish they'd talk less about their faith. And if they were to do so, I wish they would do so in much more honest and, you know, less in ways that their handlers seem to be giving them kind of, you know, market research on this is going to work with this demographic, say this for that demographic.
Let me see what Catherine from Princeton has to say. Catherine, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. I was agreeing with the guest was saying,
yes,
except for the fact that he said that the evangelical movement is nonviolent. That is not true. What about all of the abortion clinics and abortion workers and women's health care workers in abortion situations that have been killed in the name of evangelical Christianism? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Catherine, thanks for the call. I was going to pick up on that. Jacques, go ahead.
Yeah, Catherine, I think you're right, actually. That slipped my mind. Now, that is the fringe, right? I'm very happy you mentioned that. That is the fringe, but that is completely unacceptable, and it does grow out of a very, very small extremist, violent, even terrorist minority within that community, though I do see the connection. So I stand corrected. Thank you, Catherine.
Yeah, thank you. Catherine, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let's see what Ken from Lansdale has to say. And Ken, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, morning. I doubt there's been an American of the past century more publicly identified with Christianity than the Reverend Billy Graham. Hmm. And just in 1997, you know, well after the Falwell group had been well underway, in a televised interview, Graham was asked if America is a Christian country. And his answer, he said, no, we're not a Christian country. We've never been a Christian country. We're a secular country by our Constitution in which Christians live and have a voice, but we're not a Christian country. That seems to me, if somebody like Billy Graham didn't regard secularism as some kind of a threat to Christianity, you'd think that maybe, you know, modern Christian leaders could look at it the same way. Anyway, I'll take your comments off the air.
Okay, Ken, it's a great call. Jacques Berliner Blau, go ahead.
Thank you, Ken. Great point. I was not familiar with that, that quote from Reverend Graham. I mean, he said it. Now, as we know, in the 60s and 70s, Billy Graham behind the scenes was everywhere. He was like the Prometheus of church-state meddling, right? So, I mean, he definitely said it. Did he respect those church-state boundaries? Every biography of him that I've read suggests that no, he did not. However, one really interesting thing about Billy Graham is he was interviewed, I think, 2 years ago in January by, was it Christian Century or Christianity Today? And they asked him if he had any regrets.
Huh.
And this is really interesting. Billy Graham fell back on that old Christian intuition, which I mentioned from the Bible about, you know, church and state. And he said, yeah, maybe I shouldn't have meddled in politics as much as I did. Many Christians, by the way, who get really, really involved in the political process at the end of their lives, look back and say, yeah, I think I overdid it there. That might have been a mistake.
Hmm. Ken, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Picking up on this kind of revival that you're calling for, where secularists and moderate religious people come together, What would a platform like that look like? What would they want?
What would secularists want?
What do secularists want?
Well, the first thing is we'd hold out kind of these three, we balance principles as secularists, right? The first thing is we want freedom of religion. That's really, really important. Now, we need to balance that, right, with a respect for freedom from religion, right? And kind of the third tip of the triangle is, and this must be very, very orderly. Mm. So we want a state that really thinks hard about granting its citizens religious liberty, but at the same time understands that it can't do so in a way that takes away fundamental rights or seems to, let's say, elevate religion over non-belief. That's a very, very hard task. One thing I said I wanted to do in the book is I kind of wanted to blow up secularism. Mm-hmm. I wanted to sort of undermine the foundations and start from scratch. But I think these are the questions that secularists need to be asking themselves. What shouldn't they be asking themselves, or what seems to me a dead end? All this anger about a creche appearing in front of a post office or the World Trade Center cross. Mr. Madison referred to unessential differences as he was contemplating some of his own earlier church-state trespasses. And he said, sometimes you've just got to let it go, all right? They're just going to be places, small, minor, symbolic places, where church and state touch, let it go. The new secularism that I'm envisioning is going to put that to the side and really think big about these two constituencies, right? The religious moderates, who are huge, and the non-believers, God bless them, may they grow, right? Let those two groups work together to create a very, very different America from what we have right now.
Well, let me get you to be even more specific. If the issue was something like gay marriage or contraception, which we mentioned earlier, or school prayer or teaching evolution, mm-hmm. Can this group, as you envision it, come together and make a forceful argument on these issues?
Yes, you give me the there are five issues there. Give me
yes.
one and tell which one.
Well, let's take gay marriage.
Right. Why should the state in any way get involved in the personal romantic decisions of citizens, right? So I think most of America is already there on that issue, right? So Americans understand if somebody wishes to marry somebody of the same gender, if they love one another, marriage is a good thing, it's a healthy institution. The state has no business. The state is agnostic, in fact, on whether it's better for a man and a man or a man and a woman to seek the bonds of matrimony, all right? And it's an interesting secular issue because you have more than half of Americans who absolutely concur, right? You have Republicans who concur. So this is a great issue for the secular movement to work arm in arm, right, with the LGBT movement and work together to make sure that we understand, right, that this is a secular value, that we need not infuse our domestic policy with rather provincial religious views on what constitutes healthy or unhealthy love.
How about evolution?
Well, evolution is more complex. I'm not a scientist. I am very, very concerned about the kind of degradation of science in terms of public policy in the United States. I would want my children, absolutely, to be taught evolutionary theory. I think the way you approach it is you look at the alternatives. The alternative is creationism or intelligent design. And I think court after court has recognized that this is not some scientific worldview. It's a very, very particular form of Christian theology, which emerges from a very, very particular segment of the Christian world. So once again, we don't establish that. That's what our First Amendment is there to teach us, right? To permit these types of perspectives into the classroom is tantamount to an establishment of religion. And I would approach that particular problem along those lines.
Let me see what Anne from Philadelphia has to say. And Anne, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome.
First, I want to say that I'm a secular humanist, and I consider that my religion because that's where I get my values from. But saying that, there's an article in the Constitution that prohibits a litmus test for religious for religious beliefs of any elected or appointed official in the United States.
Right.
And the right, not only the religious right, but the whole right, has been completely trashing the Constitution in their ignoring of that provision. That means you don't have to have a religion, not only a specific religion.
No, fair enough. And I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Jacques, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, there were some really interesting moments, though. Think about Herman Cain. When Herman Cain was speculating as to what a Cain administration would look like, he mentioned that he didn't feel comfortable having Muslims there. Remember that? That was back in March, I think.
Yes.
What's really interesting is that at a debate, Mitt Romney called him on it, which was one of the few kind of secular paroxysms, right, that Romney actually had in this campaign. Like, he remembered, as a Mormon, what it's like to be a religious minority. So he really upbraided Cain and said, no, that's not the way we do things in America. So I think even within the Republican Party, there's an understanding, right, that religious tests are not kosher, if you will. One other thing, Anne mentioned that she's a secular humanist. In the book, I do talk about the secular humanistic movement, because I'm very interested by it. I think there was a lot of accomplishment there. A lot of new ground was opened up, and there were certain things that didn't work out quite as well as they would have liked, right? But secular humanism is something we haven't really discussed. There's atheism, there's secularism, there's secular humanism. There are a lot of isms, Marty, and we need to be able to distinguish them.
Well, but do you think someone who calls himself a secular humanist could run for high office?
Well, they could definitely run. I don't think they would win,
no.
Right? Which, when I speak to secular groups, and I speak to them actually quite frequently, all right, I always tell them, don't worry about the creche in front of the post office. I know that's annoying. Think about this. Find a district in the United States. Do some demographic research where you find a lot of people who claim to be either secularly religious or non-believers or secular humanists, and run a congressional candidate there, right? As of now, we only have one member of Congress who claims, sometimes he does, sometimes he doesn't, to be an atheist. That's Pete Stark out in California, right? So if I were to do secular activism, and I'm a professor, I don't do that, right? I would find these San Francisco, Manhattan, right? Parts of Chicago, parts of Atlanta, Austin, Texas, right? Find the districts where you do have religious liberals and non-believers, put up some money, and start running, you know, 20 Congress people across the country. If three or four win, you have a secular caucus all of a sudden, right? Wouldn't that be incredible?
I mean, that
would be secular
incredible.
Caucus in Congress.
Who would think it? Well, Jacques Berliner Blau, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Well, Marty, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And the book is called How to Be Secular, A Call to Arms for Religious Freedom. And Jacques Berliner Blau is a professor at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service, director of the Program for Jewish Civilization. And you can also read some of his columns at the Washington Post on Faith column. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us. Do stay with us for Hour 2.